I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Following the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in April of 1968, civil unrest broke out in cities across the country. But it wasn't until 5 days later, on April 9th, that violence broke out in Kansas City 50 years ago today. After 3 days of turmoil, at least six people had died. But what spurred the unrest? Last week, KCUR hosted a community panel to ask local leaders about their recollections. Today, we'll listen back to that conversation and reflect on how Kansas City has or hasn't changed over the past half century. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Last Wednesday evening, KCUR, Up to Date, and the Miller-Nichols Library at UMKC hosted Reaction or Riot, Understanding 1968 in Kansas City. Today we bring you highlights from the conversation that took place in Pearson Auditorium on the UMKC campus. Good evening and welcome to the campus of the University of Missouri, Kansas City for our program that looks back at the events of 50 years ago in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, host of KCUR's Up to Date.
And I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson. I am the Race, Identity, and Culture Reporter at KCUR, and I'm one of your hosts tonight. As we discuss Reaction, Our Riot, Understanding 1968 in Kansas City.
50 years ago today, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis.
Within a day or two, peaceful protests took place in Kansas City, Kansas, and in Kansas City, Missouri. There were a few disturbances, but nothing major.
But in those first 3 days following King's death, in nearly 130 other cities across the country, riots had erupted, causing 39 deaths, 2,500 injuries, and tens of millions of dollars in property damage. But that level of violence was not seen here, at least not initially.
5 days after Dr. King's death, April 9th, was the day of his funeral. Kansas City, Kansas officials had canceled schools so that students could remember the civil rights leader and participate in a public mourning. Kansas City, Missouri school officials, in consultation with the police, decided not to. They thought it was better to keep kids off the streets.
Soon after the school day started, Central Junior High School Principal James Field made an urgent call to police. Students, he said, were trying to tear up the building. That event wound up triggering a series of confrontations on the east side and downtown that would result in 3 days of rioting.
In the days to come, Kansas City joined many other cities in what some have characterized as race riots. It lasted 3 days with isolated incidents of fires and property damage before and after those days. It left six black people dead and hundreds of people, both black and white, injured.
Hundreds more were arrested and many stayed in jail for weeks on bonds of $50,000 or more. More than 3,000 National Guardsmen patrolled our streets, along with 180 state troopers and 940 city police officers. Hundreds of buildings were destroyed, the amount of damage in today's dollars reaching nearly $28 million.
So that's one of our topics tonight. What happened 50 years ago in our town, in our city, in our community? Why did it happen? And how much, if anything, has changed?
And what a distinguished panel we have here tonight to offer their reflections on the events of 50 years ago.
Alvin Brooks served on City Council and has headed the city's Human Rights Commission as well as the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime. And he was just reelected yesterday to the Hickman Mills School Board. Congratulations.
Next to Al is Rebecca Davis. She's a history professor here at UMKC. She teaches African American history and history of the 1960s.
Awesome. Micah Kubik is executive director of the ACLU of Kansas. He's the author of Freedom, Inc. and The Fight for African-American Empowerment, published by the University of Missouri Press in 2016.
And finally today, the Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard is a senior pastor at St. Mark Union Church and the president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Greater Kansas City. Well, L. Brooks, let's get started. What's your understanding of how this uprising began?
In 1968, I was with the Kansas City School District, and actually when the on Monday evening that James Hazard, who was the superintendent, called a meeting with about 9 or 11 people, and Dr. Eddie DeCamel and Bob Wheel and myself were the three black members. The discussion was, should we open the school? The three of us said, don't open the school, and we said, why? As a result of that, we had the confrontation on that Tuesday the 9th. The kids marched, and some thousand of them down to City Hall, and someone threw a Coke bottle, tear gas came, ordered buses. One of the police officers threw tear gas in the bus in front of the police station, and then over to the Holy Name Catholic Church where they threw tear gas in the basement where the kids were.
Al, why were the kids so frustrated when they couldn't get out of school that day?
Well, because they knew that Kansas City, Kansas kids were out. It was broadcast that evening that they were out. And that was why we had said to Hazard and to the others, don't open the schools because you allow the kids to come together where they can easily get together, but if they were out coming together as they did, it wouldn't happen. And so from started at Lincoln, then Central, then Manual, and then Paseo, and then on around 31st in Indiana when the police tried to get them to go back into Central, that didn't happen. They went up to 31st and Truce. They were tear gassed at 31st and Truce. They all assembled at Truce Lake at 27th and Paseo and began to march north on down. The mayor met them at 17th Terrace and Paseo, said he would march down to City Hall with them. Police said, Mr. Mayor, you can't do that. Put him in the car. So there are those of us, Curtis McClinton, Otis Taylor, the chiefs, Kenneth Ray, Reverend Kenneth Ray, and myself, and Watkins, Bruce Watkins, were walking with them westbound and eastbound lane. And, of course, when we got down to City Hall, the mayor spoke, a number of other persons spoke, I spoke. And that's when one of the air personalities of a KPRS, the black-owned radio station, called Father Timothy Gibbons over at Holy Name and asked him if he would open the church for the kids to go. They went over there. That's when the police followed them over there and tear-gassed at the church.
Micah, I've talked with you about this, and you have done an amazing amount of research on that time. You've talked to a lot of people. You've written a couple of really compelling books. Why do you think that this occurred when people thought that it wouldn't happen in Kansas City?
Right, so I think there are a couple of things that are very interesting and special about the urban rebellion that took place in Kansas City in 1968. First of all, in most of the country, the unrest, the uprisings happened immediately after the assassination of Dr. King. Whereas here in Kansas City, it took a couple days before something happened. That's one. Second of all, even on the day that the unrest began, there were a lot of folks who didn't think anything was going to happen. You know, I hate to pick on the Kansas City Star. It was an afternoon newspaper, and if you read the coverage from April 9th, the day of the funeral, 1968, the headlines are almost gloating about the fact that nothing happened in Kansas City, almost at the very moment that tear gas is being dispersed, priests are being beaten by police officers, and the violence is beginning. I think the other thing that is important to note is that even though we talk about this in the context of Dr. King's assassination, that's not really what it's about, right? We want to make it about one particular person and make it, oh, people just got upset that something happened to one guy, as important as he was, as significant as he was. Urban rebellions, uprisings, social movements, progress, change are never just about one person, right? The assassination of Dr. King and the disrespect that people thought was being shown to him and his memory contributed to the events, but they weren't what the whole thing was about. It was about bigger patterns of residential segregation, of a long institutional lived experience. It was about the schools and desegregation there. It was about lack of economic opportunity. All of these things contribute, and it's not just about one individual, as important as he was. That's not what it's all about, and it's a mistake to think about it that
Professor
way.
Davis, let's go with that for a moment. Give us a larger context nationally. What else was churning out there across the country in at the moment of King's assassination that led to all this anger that was out there?
Well, we also have to remember, this is 1968. I mean, it's one of the most tumultuous years that this country has ever had. I mean, we have things going on internationally in Vietnam. We have things going on domestically. This is a period of many civil rights movements, like plural. We've got LGBT rights, even though we're not too Stonewall yet. There's the women's movement. There's struggles in the Latinx community. There's lots of anger because this country was a country that benefited rich white people and stood on the shoulders of everyone else. And so it was about time that some of that tension and that anger kind of boiled over.
Reverend Howard, what would you add to that? Where were you on the day of King's assassination?
My big brother, who has deceased now and is 11 years older than me, actually put me on his shoulders. And we actually did go down to the downtown area. And I remember being by the Central Blacktop. And I was only 4 or 5 years old at that time, but I was on his shoulders. And I can remember the chaos. I can remember a great number of people all around, young and old. I would say that the unrest, as it has been called, or the uprising, as it has been called, I believe is a symptom of simply a lack of justice. There is only so much that the soul of a person, or the soul of a people, or the soul of a community can take. And the lack of peace, if you will, was simply the manifestation of turmoil that was already inside of people. If you can kill the most diplomatic, peace-seeking, humble, scholarly, academic, Nobel Peace Prize-winning, white, starch shirt suit wearing Black Baptist conservative preacher who was the hope for justice and who would harm no one, if he can be killed and it be all right, then what hope is left?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're looking back 50 years ago to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and its aftermath in Kansas City, Michelle.
One of my questions, and even as we prepared for this, is how we frame this, and you got to it a little bit, Reverend, is this a reaction or is this a riot? And like in today's terminology, we have other words for events that happen. Uprising is always a good one. Mr. Brooks, what do you think about how we frame it in terms of the word we use?
But if I might just back up just a little bit. In 1964, the city council passed a public accommodations ordinance. A group of tavern owners, beginning with the owner of Chestnut Inn at 12th and Chestnut, gathered enough signatures to put it on the ballot for a referendum. It barely passed. If it wasn't for Freedom Incorporated, who galvanized the black community and a large number of persons in the Jewish community that supported it, it narrowly passed. 1968, January, the city council passed a housing ordinance. That same group then gathered enough signatures to have it on a referendum. If it had not been for the riot, there would not have been fair housing in Kansas City. If the public accommodation narrowly passed because the white community did not support it, fair housing was much more personal. They certainly wouldn't have passed that. So if the kids did nothing else, they caused the city to have, by emergency measure, that put the warrant ordinance in effect for the health, safety, and welfare of the community. So I think that's a backdrop, because those, even though they passed public accommodation in 64, you couldn't still go to a number of places and eat. And Fairland Park was one place that refused to let, in spite of the public accommodation. So all that anger on the part of those of us who were adults passed it on to our children. They hear us talk, and we pass it on. So all that anger is built up. They just took it to a point beyond that, that 9th of April. And then, of course, adults began to do other things, a firebomb and all that. What's important, what you call it is not important. The important thing is that we had a black-white kind of relationship that had existed for years, as has been said, and moved to the point that the police were the ones who were the containment. Let me say this. I can remember one of the captains who spoke over in the plaza that told the plaza businessmen, you don't have to worry, we've got them contained down there. The same thing happened at 31st and Truce. That same captain made that statement to the business people up and down Truce. Don't worry about it. They're not going to come. We've got them contained out there. 2 weeks before the riot, I was one of six persons on a panel at the Jewish Community Center at 82nd and Holmes. The other five persons, the two mayors, Kansas City, Kansas, Missouri, the core Congress of Racial Equality chair, I was the one on the Missouri side, and NAACP. I got kind of radical and said the same thing that happened in Newark and other cities can happen in Kansas City because of the relationship between the police and the black community, and the police will start the riot. I got booed. 2 weeks later, we had the riot. Nobody ever apologized. I didn't need to, but I'm just saying that... So it's not important what we call that. It was race involved, but is racism. As the Kerner Report said in 1968, came out, that white developed the institutions and they maintained it. They did it then, and to a great degree, it's done now.
Thank you.
And all you have to do is look at 45 in the White House, and you can tell what's going on. The same thing.
So... Mike, in your research for your books, did you find that how they viewed the events of 68, what word choices that they used, colored, pun not intended,
sure.
How they viewed things?
So, you know, Mr. Brooks alluded to the Kerner Commission, which was this commission put together by the White House to study uprisings around the country, particularly in the aftermath of Watts. Kansas City had its own sort of miniature version of the Kerner Commission that was put together by the mayor after the events to sort of examine what happened. And they did some polling data as part of that, which found largely that African Americans felt that there had been meaningful concessions that the city made after the uprising to try and make the violence stop. Whereas whites generally thought it was outside agitators, troublemakers, bussed in from elsewhere who came and stirred everything up. I don't think you could come up with two more disparate ideas of what happened than that. I think what we call it matters because riots are, by definition, senseless. They're senseless. They have no purpose. They are not designed to achieve anything other than perhaps destruction. And usually when we think of riot, we think of something that is completely, totally spontaneous in the moment, period. I think of this and the 700 other similar events that occurred across the United States in the 1960s as rebellions. Because even if they were spontaneous, they were designed to achieve something. That's why they kept happening. Because people found that it was the only way that government was willing to listen. You know, the Civil Rights Act was bottled up for years. The Voting Rights Act was bottled up for years. It took until 1968 and the assassination of Dr. King before the Fair Housing Act was passed, even though the first version of it was introduced in the 1920s. People reacted because they saw that was something that would achieve something. And that's what a rebellion does. It helps you achieve something. It can still be violent. It can still be spontaneous, but it is designed to achieve some sort of goal. And I think there is no question that the folks who were participating at the time thought that they were going to achieve something as a result of their interaction. You can tell that just by the fact that it took a couple days. You can tell that tells you that there's some element of thought going into it by itself. So I think it matters to call it a rebellion, and I think it matters to acknowledge that purposeful intent, which is something that the folks on the mayor's commission about this did not do. In fact, in their conclusion to their report, they basically said there's so much emotional distress in the black community because of social pressures that basically everybody just went crazy at once. That was essentially their conclusion. It says that emotional distress got to a breaking point. There was a psychological break. I think that's a bunch of bunk.
Reverend Howard, let's talk about violence for a minute. You head the Southern Christian Leadership Conference here in town. That was a group that was founded by Dr. King and was a prime advocate of nonviolence to achieve its objectives. How did the violence in Kansas City and then across the nation at that time impact the work of the SCLC going forward? Because there was a big debate at the time, as you know, between those who were committed to advocating nonviolence and those who wanted to ratchet it up a little bit.
I do think that, and if I can just pivot to that question in a moment, I do agree that it matters what we call it as well, because words do matter. And the labeling of a group's collective behavior, when compared, for example, to, let's say, the Boston Tea Party, or to some other rebellions, if you will, that may be termed for one reason or another as more positive than others, when they both are in fact combating injustice. And so we have a tendency to call those rebellions or the social unrest by one group as negative and another as positive based upon our framework and perception of those groups. But I do believe that with respect to the violence, this is the reason why the legacy of Dr. King is so significant, and why we are fighting even today to have Paseo Boulevard changed in its name after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, because there was this sense that this man was presenting not only an end of peace and justice, but was presenting peace as a method to that end. And if the society does not embrace proper means and methods toward and agreed upon ends, then we could, in the process of pursuing justice, destroy ourselves and self-destruct. And I believe that is the valuable contribution of Dr. King, that he had the spiritual tenacity and the wherewithal to believe that how you achieve justice is just as important to the achievement of that justice. And I think that's very important.
Professor, so you teach history at UMKC. Do you think that in teaching it from books, which is, you know, how you teach history normally, that your students who weren't there have a good context for what they're learning about when they're learning about the 1960s?
Depends on the book. I try not to approach history in that way. So I know that one of the projects that my students do, we don't do it every semester, but one of the projects is that they go over to Labadie Special Collections and they look at the 1968 riot photographs. And they've written papers like based on that, and they get to get in there with their white gloves and kind of experience history the same way that a historian does. I try really hard to make sure that it's not just this idea that all you have to do is read one of these and then therefore you know
right.
everything that happened. So listening to oral histories and everything else. So I rely on some print materials, but absolutely you can't possibly kind of grasp all the rich history there is simply based on what some historian wrote after they visited the archives, looking at the primary sources and everything else. Trying to make history relevant and talking about language and bias and things in those sources. So I'm going to agree with most of the other panelists and say that I agree that the word that we use matters. I bristle any time somebody talks about a riot, because I want them to kind of think about where that word came from. Is that a word that the media used, or did you just use it because many times the word riot is used when there is a rebellion, or I like to talk about perhaps violent protests that became violent. So when we think about the fact that what happened on April 9th, 1968, initially was high school students peacefully walking out of school and going to City Hall and being met by police officers with tear gas canisters. Like, whatever violence there was provoked by the police. So it starts as a violent protest, and then we label it a riot because of the fact that it involved black youth. I mean, because I agree, when we talk about riots, like, they're senseless. I mean, it has to do with looting and destruction of property. And so when we saw what was going on in Ferguson, everybody's like, oh, well, that's a riot. I'm like, wait, hold on, stop. So I think that the word matters, and I have had many an argument with people when they try to use the word riots, and we kind of stop and we talk about what it is that they mean by that. I have a problem with the fact that we can watch footage of, I don't want to pinpoint a particular group of fans, but let's just say football fans. Yeah. Celebrating a victory of their team by going out and catching things on fire and overturning cars, and that's a celebration. And kids like blowing off steam, and the reality is that it's called a celebration because that group happens to be white. But when you look at footage that looks exactly the same, and that group is a group of color, then it's a riot. So I think that the word matters.
We're talking about Kansas City's reaction to the death of Dr. Martin Luther King 50 years ago. Al Brooks, how much culpability does the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department have for what happened in Kansas City 50 years ago?
Well, I think it's quite obvious that it was almost like what happened at Chicago's Democratic Convention. It was a police riot. And if the police were the ones that threw the tear gas, started it, the kids began to run. The two priests that I saw beaten, one black, one white, Episcopal priest right there, laying out on the line. Another man was standing just watching, and he wouldn't move. They beat him. And so I think that it was, the report never said that the police were wrong. They could never, in this report. So, I mean, and it's at that particular time, I guess it, we were taught when we were in recruit school that you never admit, you never apologize. That's changed, I believe. But so the police were right in the middle of all of it, and they created situations. I would remember being with three ministers going south on Woodland up to Lincoln High School, 2111 Woodland, and there was a police car with two police officers in the front and then two National Guard in the back, and they stopped in front of the school and began to taunt the kids. And so the kids were looking around something to throw, and so one of the police officers, I didn't see this, but I knew it had happened because they went through a canister of gas in the girls' restrooms. There, all the kids ran out the back, so they wouldn't let us drive up there, so we walked up there, so we saw the gas because the gas was all through Lincoln High School. So I think those kind of things. Yeah, and the same thing happened at Holy Name. I mean, there was no reason for them to throw tear gas in the basement of Holy Name Catholic Church. The kids had a right to taunt them. They had a right to whatever they were doing at the time. But did the means justify? I doubt it. It did not justify them throwing tear gas and the kids all out there in the street on the lawn in front of Holy Name. So I mean, and I think even in situations like Ferguson and other communities. Police, 21st century policing is different, should be, than it was in the 60s and 70s, 80s. But to some degree it is. I think that there is some progress made in Kansas. If you'd asked me what's the difference between the Kansas City Police Department in 1968 and 2018, I've said a lot of difference. But it's interesting, the same thing that this report said that the community needed to do is the same thing that needs to be done today. We fell far short, and that was 50 years ago, and we're still talking about education, housing, education, housing, police community relations, economic development, the same thing that this report that was issued in August the 18th, 15th, 1968, the same thing.
But Micah Kubik, this incident at Holy Name Catholic Church is pivotal to our conversation here. Tell us in a little more detail what happened at the church on the same day that all this began.
Right. So as Mr. Brooks was mentioning, many of the participants in the nonviolent protest marches earlier in the day were young people, were students, were from the school district. And knowing that there were many youth who were going to be out in the community, some folks, including the owners of the KPRS radio station, decided to host a community dance that evening at the Holy Name Church. They called the police to tell them that they would be having the event at the Holy Name Church to try and make it easier for young people to get to the church unaccosted without any problem. Because there were interactions going on between police and protesters during the day and the early evening, the police were out and about in the community. And they claimed, after the fact, that they saw two protesters who threw a rock at police, saw them go into the basement of the Holy Name Church. Other folks claim that that did not happen, but that was the story that the police officers involved gave. And so, rather than going into the basement of the Holy Name Church to try and apprehend those two individuals, or reaching out to the church in any way, or doing anything at all, even contacting their supervisors, what they decided to do was throw tear gas canisters into the open window of the basement where the dance was taking place. You can imagine what happens in a closed basement when tear gas canisters go in and there are several hundred young people down there in the basement. You can understand why people would be upset about this. And that was sort of the flashpoint that caused all of the violence and interactions to accelerate dramatically, right? That was just beyond the pale for even folks who so far had not really been bothered, frankly, by police conduct, who hadn't been bothered by the other tear gas, who hadn't been bothered by the priests being beat up, who hadn't been bothered by the fact that when the mayor came to lead the protest march downtown, the police turned him away, said that he wasn't allowed to enter, and he had to call the police chief, Clarence Kelly, himself on the phone to get them to be admitted to downtown. Finally, when they threw canisters in a closed basement, that was the thing that finally some folks said was too much. The only person who never said that that was too much, who continued to defend it until the day he died, was the police chief of Kansas City, Clarence Kelly, who I think it is important to note worked in Alabama for the FBI in the 1950s and helped run the so-called informant program that the FBI had with the KKK at the time.
Okay, I think that gives us a pretty good sense of what happened here in Kansas City. When we come back, we're going to switch our focus and talk about what Al Brooks has already alluded to, how much has changed. You're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, we met two students lobbying for college kids' priorities in the Topeka and Jefferson City State Houses. Hear their thoughts on how our government works at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we meet three Kansas Appeals Court judges who are taking their show on the road. They'll tell us why they're hearing cases at Johnson County Community College. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Now, let's return to highlights from Wednesday's event, Reaction or Riot, Understanding 1968 in Kansas City.
We're joined by an excellent set of panelists, Elvin Brooks, who holds more titles than any person in the history of humanity. Rebecca Davis is a history professor at UMKC, Micah Kubek, executive director of the ACLU of Kansas, and the Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard, senior pastor at St. Mark Union Church, also president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference here in Kansas City. Now we'll look at this important question: how much has changed, or rather maybe how much hasn't changed in the wake of all this violence in our town? I want to begin with a question for Dr. Howard. The question on the table: how much has changed since the events of 50 years ago?
Well, if we could utilize the question that surfaced prior to our break with respect to law enforcement, Black America has always experienced during our time here in this country law enforcement as an arm and instrument that in fact reinforces the oppression and keeps uprising, rebellion, revolution from happening. That is the way that Black America has experienced, by and large, law enforcement within the context of the oppression of Black people. Whether it has been seeing a video of the shooting of Mr. Alton, where the police officer says to him, using the N-word, "I'm going to shoot you in your head if you don't calm down, if you don't be quiet," or whether it is the multitude of lynchings that in America went unpunished, unrecognized, unacknowledged. Law enforcement, either through its activity or its inactivity, has been experienced as that which reinforces black oppression and keeps black people, quote, in their place, end quote. I do think that as we move into the change that is needed, that there is going to have to be, I think, serious strategies that involve not just African-American victims of police brutality and law enforcement that functions as such, but there's going to have to be a cadre of courageous white folks that say, this is wrong, whether it happens to black people or to people in my community and to my children.
Micah Kubik, take a run at that, would you please? How much has changed?
Sure. So I think the cliche, stereotypical answer that we're all supposed to make here is we've come so far, but we have so far still to go. That's what you usually hear. I think there's a tiny bit of truth in that because that's how something becomes a cliche in the first place. But I think although there has clearly been some progress, police tactics are different today than they were then. There has been some modest progress in terms of income and employment, right? I think if you look at any quick statistical snapshot, it will tell you the story, right? The black-white wealth gap is growing, not reducing. Even when black unemployment is low, you can do a math calculation and it will always be twice the rate of white unemployment. It has been every single quarter since they have recorded statistics. You can look at the fact that residential segregation now is worse than it was in 1954 at the time of Brown versus Board, and we just mourned the death of Linda Brown. You can look at all of that and see that there's a lot of progress, a lot of progress that has not been made. I think two other things stand out, right? Not just policing interactions, but the product of those interactions, right? The criminal justice system, that we have an epidemic of mass incarceration that disproportionately impacts black and brown people. You've probably read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, a fantastic book. I like it. My issue with it is an article problem. I don't like that article at the beginning, The New Jim Crow. Makes it sound like it is the only thing, the one instance where Jim Crow is still alive and well. No, it's a new Jim Crow. And we see that new Jim Crow every day in a million different ways. I think, you know, in 1968, people were talking about voting rights. We're talking about voting rights today. In 1968, people were talking about housing. We're talking about fair housing today. In 1968, people were talking about lack of access to jobs. We're talking about it today. We're still talking about it. And we're going to keep talking about it until something gets done about it. Because just like they said then, freedom is a constant struggle. Freedom is a constant struggle. It's a song they sang in Mississippi during the Civil Rights Movement. Freedom is a constant struggle. Oh, Lord, we've struggled so long. Surely we must be free. Well, we're not free yet, but we're going to be.
Rebecca Davis, you're used to taking the long view. You teach history at UMKC. How much do you think has changed?
All we have to do is look around us and again, we're talking about the same things. We had high school students walking out of class on April 9th, 1968 to protest what they believe, many different things, not only the lack of empathy, perhaps, or recognition of a fallen civil rights leader. We had high school students walking out of class, 3 weeks ago? And, I mean, you look at them and they look the same. I mean, I'm glad that we have a more integrated front, if you will. I mean, that there were white students, there were students of color. I mean, that there were all kinds of different types of faces in that crowd that we saw a couple weeks ago. But it's really frustrating to continue to have to beat your head against the wall because we keep talking about the same things and they just reinvent themselves in different or even the exact same way. So, I mean, as a historian, I would say that one of the benefits of being a historian is that we kind of understand, or we try to understand the past, but then the same pitfall is that we understand, or we try to understand the past, and we can kind of see these continued threads that repeat themselves. And the other cliche is, well, history repeats itself. And I've never really liked that one. I like Mark Twain's line where he said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I'm like, yes, that's the one I like, because that one seems to be kind of the truism. But, I mean, it's really frustrating to hear people say, I was having a discussion with a relative of mine, and her comment, and it was after the Facebook Live video of Philando Castile, and her comment was, every time I turn on the television, it seems like I see another video or another incident of another unarmed black man being shot by police. She's like, it's almost like this has been happening all along. We just didn't know it. And I'm like, no, it's not almost like that. It's exactly like that. It's just now we see it. And then even though we see it, there still hasn't been any progress to do anything about it. So that's the thing that, I mean, it's just so unbelievably frustrating, is like, where do we go from here? I'm not sure, because you have to have, we have to have a government that's willing to do it. We need to have a Congress that's willing to do it. We need to have, as you said, a lot of like good white people who are like, yes, this is wrong. This is what we need to do. I mean, but all of those things need to come together. And frankly, I don't see that happening right now.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to an event that looked back at the events following the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in Kansas City. Dr. Howard, you want to say something here?
I do believe that the emphasis on education is extremely important, and the focus on integration in education some years ago, some 50 or 60 years ago, did not solve the educational equity problem. We know now that there should have been focus on equality of quality, as opposed to integrating and believing that that would produce the outcome of better education. And so I believe that it is right. I agree with Mr. Brooks and our previous speaker. However, we can adequately educate absolutely every child of color and white children and perfectly equip them to enter the marketplace to earn money and obtain jobs. And yet, there will still be this glaring number of jobs within our economy and within the marketplace that only produce a certain amount of money when they are worked. If we want to really think about Dr. King on April the 4th, when he was shot 50 years ago, we should not remember, not forget ever, that his proposal was a guaranteed annual income for absolutely every American who takes the responsibility to work for a living. And that did not matter whether you had a GED or no degree. If you're willing to work, when he said, where we go from here, we go guaranteed annual income. And we don't like to hear that, I know. But when we talk about following him, that's where he was going.
If you want to come up to the microphone and ask a question, as Steve said earlier, his show only runs an hour. So if you could sort of just keep focused and short.
I'll try to get quickly to the question. Almost on a daily basis, I feel very overwhelmed. I feel like I don't know what to do. I feel like there's so much to do. I don't know where to start. So I'm hopeful that you guys can suggest some practical ways that me, as an obvious white person, can do something that's impactful, regular, on a daily basis, that will actually help to solve this problem.
I say find like-minded persons like yourself, and I don't know whether you're one that's a churchgoer or a synagogue or whatever, but I think find like persons are thinking like you're in there and start a discussion group about this, a sincere discussion group dealing with issues like racism and those kind of things. I think starting there would certainly help And what Dr. Hardy said is important, but I think just getting other like-minded persons who you know. Sometimes family members aren't like-minded folks, but there are some like-minded folks, I'm sure, out there that can start something within your congregation, within your neighborhood, your homes association.
Your question and your comment about how do I do that, like as a white woman, is something that I grapple with all the time, because my specialty is African American history and civil rights. So I try really hard to make sure that I let people of color speak and that I don't try to tell them what their story is or what it should be or how they should feel. So how is it that we can be allies without trying to kind of make that story one of our own? And that's a hard kind of balance to find sometimes.
So I think a couple things. First of all, I work for the ACLU in Kansas. I understand the feeling of being overwhelmed. I think if you want to attack any problem, right, the first thing, one of the best things you can do is pick a piece of it, right? Pick the piece that outrages you the most. Because going back to Jim's point, right, in this particular struggle, in the movement for social change, outrage is the fuel. You need outrage to sustain you. You have to have hope and values, et cetera, right? But outrage is the fuel that will drive you to actually do something. And so I think you have to pick the one thing that outrages you the most, that when you think about, you just cannot stand the fact that it exists in this world. Pick it and do something about it. And then the second thing that I think is that you should not just speak your values, you should live them. You should let your example speak for you. You should live your life in the way that resonates with your values. Do those things and let others see that that is who you are and what you believe. And I think the power of a lived example is the most powerful thing that we can do.
And to make sure that outrage is righteous, because we have a voluminous amount of outrage in America, but sometimes it's toward other races, other genders, or the sexes, other sexual orientation. And let's make sure that our outrage is not grounded in the suppression or the lack of giving dignity to somebody else. And that's prevalent in this country.
That's the voice of the Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard, senior pastor at St. Mark Union Church. We're also joined this evening by Micah Kubek, executive director of the ACLU of Kansas, Rebecca Davis, a history professor at UMKC, and Al Brooks, who was a one-time Kansas City police officer who rose to head the ad hoc group against crime and the city's Human Rights Commission. Special thanks this evening to Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Thank you for co-hosting here with me this evening. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
And with that, you've been listening to a special broadcast of KCUR's Up to Date. Thank you very much.
That was our forum on the 1968 assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the events that happened in Kansas City afterwards. It was recorded on April 4th in partnership with UMKC's Miller Nichols Library. Find all of our previous episodes online at kcur.org/up-to-date, including my conversation on Friday about fiction writing with novelist Margot Livesey. Find us on Twitter. We're at kcurup-to-date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow you've heard of touring bands and carnivals and authors, but what about touring judges? We'll meet three appeals court judges who are bringing their courtrooms to the Metro. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.